Hello, Professor Kramer. Thank you for joining me today with the Chicago Policy Review. We're going to talk about COVID-19 vaccine policy and advanced market commitments. Happy to have you here.
I'm very glad to be here.
So, why don't we start off this discussion? For those unfamiliar with the term, what exactly are advanced market commitments? And can you tell us a bit about how they were designed in the early 2000s?
Sure. Let me start with the dry economic answer and then, discuss the why they're actually very relevant to our lives. And I think that's true for a lot of economics, that when we start with sort of general principles that might seem abstract, but it is very important to our lives. So the general issue is one of patents and intellectual property rights. And those are designed to encourage innovation, which is obviously, key to economic growth, key to the huge health improvements that the world has seen over the past century. But while they're designed to encourage innovation, the particular way they do that is by giving the inventors or the product developers monopoly rights to sell the product. And a standard principle of principles of introductory principles of economics course is that monopoly rights can sometimes limit access. And that's technically, that's inefficient, if you want to put it in the very dry economic terms, that's inefficient because the social cost of producing the good might be pretty modest, which it often is for drugs or vaccines. But the producer wants to cover, they obviously want to make a profit, but they need to be covering the fixed costs. And those can be very large of developing the product, of running it through the trials that are required for approval, et cetera. So they charge more than the, literal production cost. And then that means that some people who are able to pay the production costs, but are not able to pay the price, don't get it, and that's economically efficient. And of course, that inefficiency is compounded if this is a vaccine or a drug against an infectious disease, for all of the standard externality reasons that if I take the vaccine, that doesn't just help me; it helps everybody else in society. Of course, it's complicated for vaccines, which are typically bought by governments. So, but that's the sort of abstract, economic analysis. But because we're talking about drugs and vaccines, we're talking about things that are incredibly important to human life, literally. And, the lack of the lower quantity that gets sold when there's monopoly pricing means some people don't get drugs and vaccines, and that can be literally deadly. So, at the same time, we need the research incentives there to get the products produced in the first place. So, as long as you're in a, you could, there are arguments why patents, intellectual property rights should be stronger, why they should be weaker. But as long as you're just varying the strength of intellectual property rights, you're pitting off these two very important social goals, i.e., incentives for innovation and access to the fruits of those innovations against each other. So the idea of advanced market commitments was to try to simultaneously advance both objectives. And it was focused on a particular, the idea in some ways is more general, but it was focused on a particular application, which was the lack of vaccines for diseases that were common, mostly in low-income countries. So, for example, malaria. This is something that Rachel Glennister, who's currently at the work, the chief economist for the UK Foreign, Commonwealth and Development Office, but it's coming to Chicago, and is also I'm married to. She and I wrote a book on this called Strong Medicine. And what we and we focused on the cases of things like malaria, for example. There's research incentives are much weaker than they are for, you know, things that are diseases that are common in high-income countries. And the issue of access to a vaccine once it's developed is obviously, you know, very important one. Typically, it takes a long time for new vaccines to diffuse out to lower income countries. So how can we try to get around this tension that's inherent in patents? Well, the idea was to commit in advance to help finance the purchase of the efficient quantity of the vaccine. And, you know, for a lot of vaccines, that's, we have some rough idea of it. You know, a lot of products, you know, post-it notes, you know, ex ante, we don't know what the efficient quantity of post-it notes to produce for the world is. But with a, you know, let's say it's a childhood vaccine, it's fairly inexpensive. You know, basically that the efficient quantity is to vaccinate the entire birth cohort or, you know, whatever's practical. You know, some people you won't get. So then you could, you know, specify up front that if firms produce that efficient quantity, or if they, then you would give them some reward. And, you know, the reward, you know, the particular details was to commit to help top up the prices that countries paid up to a cap, and then in exchange to ask the companies to, you know, you could try to get to the efficient quantity by writing that down ahead of time. You could also say if you specify a cap on the prices that are charged going forward, that will also get you to the efficient quantity. So that was the idea. And then you know, we wrote this book. I co-chaired a working group at the Center for Global Development to take it from a somewhat academic idea to a more detailed you know, policy idea. A number of countries, together with the Gates Foundation, pledged $1.5 billion to help finance the purchase of a vaccine against pneumococcus. And now there was already a vaccine for the strains of pneumococcus that were common in the developed world, but no vaccine had yet been developed against the strains of pneumococcus that were common in the developing world. So the donors that were behind this pledged that if firms did develop such a vaccine, and if it met certain technical standards in terms of efficacy and so on, they would help finance the purchase. And after that, you know, three different pneumococcus vaccines were developed. I don't want to claim it was, you know, we'll never know whether, you know, so there were some products pretty far along in development beforehand. So we don't know for sure whether that's a causal effect. But it's also the case that those vaccines have been rolled out much more quickly than is normal. Hundreds of millions of people have been vaccinated, and it's estimated that 700,000 lives have been saved by the pneumococcus vaccines.
That's great. So how can AMCs be thought of in the context of COVID vaccines? And what's different this time compared to pneumococcus, for example?
Yeah, well, a normal vaccine timeline would mean it's at least 3 to 4 years from initial testing to commercial, you know, commercial, large-scale commercial use. And the large-scale installation and manufacturing capacity would only happen, you know, some manufacturing capacity be installed initially, but large-scale installation would only occur after the completion of medical trials. And that takes that's a very long process. But speed is very important during the pandemic. So every month, COVID-19 is killing hundreds of thousands of people, and it's reducing global GDP by hundreds of billions of dollars. So the purpose of advanced market commitments or advanced contracting for COVID-19 vaccines was to accelerate the production process. And, you know, perhaps also incentivize the R&D, but the key one was to make sure capacity was installed at large scale and in parallel, not after with the testing process. And of course, you know, that involves some risk. So governments and international organizations sign contracts for vaccines in advance of clinical approval, because that was done to stimulate these early large-scale investments in manufacturing capacity. So you could begin production, early rather than waiting till to start the process after the vaccine was approved. Now, that involves some risk. What if the vaccines don't work? But, if you think about the scale of losses that we're facing every month, it's worth spending some money to, it's worth taking some risks, basically. And that's what, colleagues and I argued, back in the days when, actually, to be honest, we put the chance of vaccine success, we can sort of looked at the historical record, talked to experts. It wasn't that we thought, oh yeah, these vaccines are definitely going to work. Like everybody else, we thought, okay, there's a chance, but we just ran the numbers on it, and it was like, it's a no-brainer. I don't want to claim we were the only ones who were thinking about it this way. It's just a no-brainer that, yes, you might lose $13 billion or whatever we spent on warp speed, but that's a risk worth taking when every month, we have these immense losses and of both lives and economic and social losses. So part of the idea was just invest early, but partly the idea was think about the design of the contracts, because again, you want to design contracts to not only incentivize R&D, but to incentivize as broad access as possible. And in this case, we thought it would make sense to include in the contracts some provisions, not just how many doses would the government get, but include provisions on manufacturing capacity. Or say we'll pay up front for manufacturing capacity. Well, with the particular approach we advocated, say we'll pay up front for manufacturing capacity in exchange for an option to buy the vaccines if the vaccines prove successful. Again, we, like everybody else, were thinking that, a lot of candidates would fail, in which case there's no point actually exercising that option. But part of the reason we thought capacity is so important is if you think about the sort of commercial incentives facing the firm, and, they may have been acting in part for reasons beyond commercial incentives, but the commercial incentives would be it's not easy to build tons of manufacturing capacity. It's really risky as well. It's expensive at some point. There might be some cheap capacity available that's idle capacity that you can sort of contract for, relatively inexpensively, but other things might involve larger costs. If you're repurposing things away from other profitable products, et cetera, particularly in the short run. So it would tend to be, if you just contracted a number of doses, the firm might want to fulfill the order over a longer period with a smaller factory and, save some on production costs. Even if they're not being unreasonable, they did expand beyond what they'd ever done before, but you'd want them to go really far, to redouble and redouble and redouble the efforts to do this, even if it gets expensive. One way to do that in a contract is by specifying a deadline. But anybody who's been involved in contracting on a home, if you specify a deadline, that can just, those deadlines can slip unless there's some sort of penalty clause. But if you thought about a penalty clause that did anything, even starting to approximate the social costs incurred by being late, that would be a huge penalty for the company, and companies couldn't accept that. So, if you can contract actually saying part of the contract is you're supposed to install this much manufacturing capacity by the state and do, and that's a complicated thing. There's lots of things that are involved with that, but that can help, get the actual acceleration of capacity and the large scale capacity that, the world needed. One other thing I would mention on this is that, if you do things just based on deliver courses or deliver by a deadline. And that sort of puts countries in competition with one another, because you know, the company could say, okay, well, we're going to send this country to the front of the queue because it's in their contract, and this other country, they didn't write the contract carefully enough. We'll push them to the back of the queue. But if you have a contract that explicitly says you're supposed to build new capacity, you're partly building out capacity for the world, and that benefits, you know, your own country in the short run, but in the long run benefits the world. Anyway, we argued that it would be good for contracts to have some explicit element of expanding capacity. And, you know, I would say that certain, you know, there were a number of efforts that obviously, you know, were academic economists, you know, people aren't going to, you know, they're going to do what they have all sorts of, you know, factors that are going to enter into their decisions other than what academic economists are recommended. But there was a lot of similarity in the approach that, you know, at the high level, the approach taken by Operation Warp Speed or by the UK, the types of things we were advocating. And there were some international, you know, there were some other countries that had some things like that. There were some, the COVAX, you know, I think wanted to adopt an approach like this. They were somewhat constrained financially because they didn't have that much money coming in from, you know, from the donors to be able to make that type of commitment. And, you know, some of the other big actors, like for the World Bank, you know, they lend to countries. There's some institutional features. Like Bolivia is not going to be able, it's too small to be able to, you know, get capacity constructed, you know, for it alone. So there, you know, there were some, I think it was a mixed picture, but I do think that, you know, we got a lot more vaccine than, you know, talked to experts at the beginning of the pandemic, and they thought it's just not possible to expand capacity that much that quickly. There's just constraints. It's like, I mean, you know, the analogy that came up was it takes 9 months to produce a baby. You can't speed it up. And actually, you know, the world did speed it up. We've had vaccines unprecedentedly quickly in unprecedentedly large scale. You know, I think my colleagues and I would have loved to see, you know, not $13 billion spent on warp speed, but a lot more. And, you know, maybe we could have done better, but, you know, it's great what's happened, that we have the vaccine. Obviously, the key issue now is further expanding capacity so the rest of the world can be vaccinated as rapidly as possible. And I do feel that, you know, it's obviously time has passed. We need, you know, it's, you know, the sooner this happens, the better. And we've lost some time, but we now know we have a bunch of good vaccines. The risk is much lower. And I think it's worth asking companies for proposals. What could you do to expand capacity? And, you know, what would it cost? And those proposals shouldn't obviously just be judged on price. You'd want to judge what's the impact on, what's the reliability? Is this a plausible proposal? What's the efficacy of the vaccine? What pressure is it going to put on supply chains? Because you might be, you know, if you're competing over ingredients and it's a zero-sum game, you're not doing good by expanding capacity. But, you know, companies can come up with proposals to say, yeah, I'm going to use this type of formulation that isn't in such, you know, doesn't hurt the supply chains as much. Or, you know, the other element of this is very important to incentivize production along the supply chain. So you get all the inputs you need in vaccine production and not just, you know, the final production line. So quality control is going to be really important. You know, we've seen problems with that. You could, you know, one thing that's come up a lot recently is the debate over suspending patents so that, you know, companies and, you know, approach India and South Africa were, you know, advocating, and the Biden administration just came out in support. Part of the idea is, well, then that could get production going in some lower income countries that that the I think the you know one issue is vaccines are very complicated to produce. So some sort of if you want to get this going quickly, which we need socially, then having some tech transfer element is very important. And I think the knowledgeable observers are tend to agree on that. But that's something that I think one advantage of incentivizing production and contracting for production is, you could be incentivizing tech transfer as well, because you're putting some more, the view of some would be that that some of the technology leaders aren't super, they have signed a bunch of deals, but maybe they're really worried that they're going to lose control of their technology. And, for future products beyond the pandemic that, they don't want to give up their advantages there. One natural approach would be create incentives for them to do that tech transfer actively, not just to make it possible for somebody to look at the patent, but to actually make sure that the tech transfer, for one company teaching its another, potentially its rival to produce. That's not an easy thing to get, but I think we should be aiming to try and get it.
Okay, very interesting. Now, you mentioned earlier costs as being one of the factors, of course, in vaccine production. Now, to what extent are costs prohibitive in augmenting private companies' capacity to produce vaccines? In other words, what are the implications of firms failing to consider the social benefits of vaccines?
Yeah. As I've emphasized, building factory, so it's very different than drugs. For drugs, it's, for most therapeutics, if you have the formula, a generic producer can produce it. I couldn't, but, there are firms out there that can do it. Vaccines are much tougher, and lots of things can go wrong. And so it is a major decision for a firm to sink a lot into a plant, in a very big plant. And there's also the issue that, they might be worried about, hey, if we sink all this into production, what are we going to be able to recoup it? And obviously, for example, let me be specific. You might think that all the major vaccine manufacturers really jumped on this, but there are some major manufacturers who, I don't want to say they didn't make an effort, but they didn't make an effort to measure it with the social need. And I think, Peter Hotez, for example, has used the phrase once bitten, twice shy. Merck made a big effort on an Ebola vaccine, but it didn't really, I don't know the details, but I think it's worth checking this, but my understanding is they probably didn't recoup everything because once the priority shifted, and so I think being able to reduce the risks for companies is pretty important. And I guess I do think that the response of companies is can be affected by the incentives. One key thing is that the social value of a vaccine is much, much greater than the prices. Just to go a little bit more detail on the point I made earlier, the IMF has estimated global GDP losses from COVID-19 of $12 trillion during 2020-2021. Those numbers are a little bit outdated, but that would work out to average monthly GDP loss of $500 billion. So, more comprehensive estimates of harm, including the health losses, the education losses, are actually many, many times larger. So in a paper published last month, large group of co-authors, including Eric Budish here at University of Chicago, and I published a paper in Science recently, And we estimate that additional vaccine production capacity, if available in 4 months at that time, would have additional global benefits of, you know, between $570 and almost $1,000, you know, per course of annual capacity. So, you know, per ability to produce one more course per year of vaccination, so two doses for most vaccines. And if you think about the price we're currently seeing in deals with vaccine producers, it's between $6 and $40 per course. So there's a huge gap between the social and private value of vaccines at the moment. Now, to be clear, we're not necessarily saying, oh, we should raise prices to $1,000 a dose. You know, governments have, there are lots of reasons why, you know, they wouldn't probably allow that. And the vaccine companies know that too. And they also know that either for their own internal ethical reasons or because of the, you know, the political risks and, you know, legal risks, they didn't try to price at $1,000 a dose. But clearly there would have been some customers at $1,000, you know, $1,000 a, $1,000 a course or $1,000 a dose for that matter early on, and presumably still today. So, but it's just a, you know, it's a, like it or not, in a pandemic, there are going to be limits on pricing. And then that means that the firms can't recover the full social value, which means even if they make a big effort, and I think they did make a big effort, you know, there's certain things, if there's some approaches out there that would cost them $500 per course of capacity, annual course, of, you know, annual capacity, they can't, they would lose a lot of money if they did that. Now, it's obviously an empirical question. How many production technologies are there out there that could, you know, increase production once you've used up the, you know, the idle capacity, et cetera? Well, you know, there's differing views out there, and at some level, we'll never know. But I think what I would say is we've seen unprecedented increases far beyond what people thought were available earlier. I think if we said we're willing to pay more, not for every dose, which would be giving sort of a windfall to the producers, but if there's additional ways they could increase production that had a cost greater than the current price, well, it's worth it to society, and we should be willing to entertain proposals for that. And we, I think, soliciting proposals and saying, look, if the cost of the capacity is such, you know, and I would, that it's not profitable at current prices, tell us what it would cost to build that capacity, and then we'll consider that. There might be cases in which it's financially costly to divert capacity from one use to another, but it still might be socially valuable. So that's worth exploring as well. There are other things like procedures to increase yields that I think could be, you know, very promising.
Okay, very interesting. Now, on that note, at what stage of vaccine development and production do you think governments should intervene, or if at all, actually, to maximize net benefits to society? So maybe there have been failures or successes in various countries so far.
Yeah, I would say that, you know, speed is incredibly, incredibly valuable. So during a pandemic, and the private companies don't have sufficient incentives to accelerate vaccination. It's not like they get paid, you know, and they don't get paid $1,000 per dose, but they also don't get paid, you know, on a schedule. They're, you know, you deliver 1 month earlier, you get this, the bonus that's a value to society, because that actually just the bonus for early would be immense to match social needs. So I think because of the benefit of speed, it makes sense to invest in manufacturing capacity in parallel with testing. And so I think it makes sense for governments to be involved at that stage. And, you know, lots of countries did that, you know, the US and UK, but also other countries. And we're seeing the, you know, the benefits of that now. the analysis that, that in our papers suggests, you know, these investments. We also have a paper in American Economic Review's paper proceedings issue that I think may have just come out. And those are you know, the benefits of the this early production might be worth hundreds of billions or trillions of dollars. And we don't know exactly what was in the contract. So, but, you know, surveys of manufacturers suggest capacity is, you know, 5 or 10-fold greater than at the beginning of the pandemic. At this stage, I think an important thing is to think about how to use existing capacity more efficiently. I mean, it would like to still, you know, sort of get proposals, solicit proposals for more manufacturing capacity, but there might be more we can do with existing production capacity. You know, we've seen these, what the UK has done in Canada in terms of going from, you know, first doses, first policies, where there's a longer gap between the first and second dose, so more people could get that first dose, you know, that's delivering, you know, 75% protection more quickly. There may be you know, another possibility that I think is really intriguing, I think we should at least experiment with, is trying to see if it's possible to use smaller doses. So, you know, with, when I say experiment, I don't mean clinical trials necessarily, but, you know, you could start with studies to designed to look at immune response, not, you know, different than the sort of phase three clinical trials, which take a really long time and involve, you know, really large numbers of people. But there's some reason to believe that you might be able to get by with much smaller doses. And, you know, here's an extreme case, not from COVID-19, but, you know, in Brazil, there was a yellow fever crisis a few years ago. And, you know, Brazil went ahead with using 1/5 doses. That was, you know, with the full backing of the World Health Organization. And that proved very successful. And they were able to, you know, halt the outbreak. You know, I think it's worth at least starting to explore the possibility that, you know, if we can get by with half doses, well, then you know, double the supply. And, you know, together with co-authors, we've been, you know, doing some sort of epidemiological modeling, and that suggests that, you know, even if you gave up some efficacy, the gains from being able to vaccinate twice as fast, you know, would be, or whatever that, you know, would tend to mean that, you know, overall we'd be able to reduce deaths quite considerably if, you know, unless it turns out that the vaccine is, you know, that is much, much less effective once you go to a smaller dose. But I think we should at least try to find out. And, you know, that could involve, well, I'm not an expert in the best ways of, you know, in all of the best ways of, you know, starting to explore this in a responsible way. One of the members of our team is a, you know, biostatistician with experience on some of these issues, but I don't want to speculate on that too much here.
Okay, great. Now, another thing you mentioned earlier was patents in respect to creating these vaccines. So, and creating incentives as well. So how harmful are patents in this context from a social perspective? And should legislation be introduced to ban patents on vaccines, which have benefits of this magnitude that we're seeing with COVID vaccines, possibly integrating some sort of AMC-like program to maintain incentives?
I think there's multiple ways to structure advanced market commitments. So, you know, one approach is to layer an advanced market commitment on top of patents. And so, you know, that's mostly how it was done for, say, for pneumococcus. Those companies retain the patents, but you create incentives for them to produce in large quantity and to get to the, I think they should have gone further and had a larger quantity. I think that was sort of a missed opportunity. But, yes, there might have been some risk. The factory would be idle for a while because it takes countries time to, add a new vaccine to their immunization schedule. But the asymmetries are just so huge. That's a small risk relative to kids not getting a life-saving vaccine. So I would have liked that program to have been more ambitious than the capacity targets. But anyway, sorry, a bit of a digression. So one approach is you layer this on top of patents, and that preserves research incentives because it's voluntary for the companies. They only take the AMC deal if they're going to not be financially hurt relative to having a patent selling to the high-income countries first, and then eventually 10 years later, selling to lower-income countries. Okay. Another approach would be to say, well, let's make this mandatory. The way you get compensated is you sell through. You have to. It's not a voluntary deal. It's a mandatory deal. We're not going to buy from you unless you agree to these terms. And I think your position on that might depend on how much you value research incentives versus how much you value getting access to the drugs and vaccines that we already have. I think both objectives, research incentives and access, are both really important. And I would hope we would design systems that would allow us to get both.
Okay, very interesting. Now, how have developing countries been impacted by their relative disadvantage in purchasing power for vaccines? Because we've talked about rich countries a lot, but your other area of expertise, of course, are developing countries.
Yeah, obviously, it right now, people in the U.S. Are getting vaccinated, and we no longer basically, shortages are disappearing, and even young and healthy people are getting vaccinated. While in India, there's a terrible tragedy unfolding. Brazil, where vaccine supplies are very limited, and people who are much, much, much higher risk of death from COVID-19, elderly people, people with pre-existing conditions, various types, are not vaccinated. And so, there are, so what, what can we do to address that? One thing that I think is, I think there are a whole bunch of measures. First, some high-income countries that did order a lot, they're holding back on releasing supplies, or they were holding back. I think there's starting to see some movement on that. Asking questions like, well, we're going to need boosters later on. We don't know, maybe we'll find side effects and won't be able to use certain vaccines. We better play it safe and hold on to it. That obviously comes at a very high price for other countries. And we did see a move a while ago by the Biden administration to say, hey, we've got, I think a particularly, particularly extreme example of this was U.S. had a bunch of AstraZeneca vaccine, which is not approved in the U.S., and we were sitting on it. We've got plenty of Pfizer and Moderna, which have very high efficacy. And meanwhile, Mexico and Canada had they didn't have vaccine and they needed, or they had very small supplies. And so, the Biden administration eventually moved to say, hey, we're going to lend the vaccine doses. So if we need them back, we'll get them back because, for example, Canada ordered a lot. It's just not arriving quickly. I think this trying to get the world protected, I think it It's a moral imperative, but it's also in our, narrow self-interest, because, the longer the vaccine is out there, the more people are infected, the more mutations, more opportunity there's for mutations, including mutations that could spread back, to the U.S. potentially, that could be resistant to vaccines and come back. So I think that's that's now the critical problem facing the world, is accelerating access for the places that don't yet have it. And so, taking bids on more capacity, releasing the doses that we have and that are not, that can be released. Have to be politically realistic as well, but about what's actually going to happen. I mean, there are things we, wish would happen. We might wish would happen, but also have to think, realistically. I think that, in the US and UK and in Europe, we should be starting to think about looking at what could be done with, smaller doses, the first stages, and, this is, the natural, again, I'm not an expert on this, but if we did get, beyond the pharmacological type, beyond measuring the immune response to actually trying this out, very natural, it would be very natural for, Europe has a lot of continental Europe has a long, they don't have that many vaccines either. This could both directly help them and, would also mean that the rest of the world would get served quickly. And, the same may be true for Canada. And there may be people in the U.S. who, there are a lot of young people in the U.S. who are not, anti-vaxxers, but who think, well, I'm a pretty low risk. I don't want to get the vaccine. But perhaps some of them would say, hey, I'd be happy to participate in a trial to get at the impact of a lower dose because, so maybe in the US as well, you could do some trials on this, but I want to be cautious about this. It's not my field.
Very interesting. And finally, what are some lessons that we can take from this going forward for vaccine production and distribution for future pandemics?
So for to prevent future pandemics, it's really going to be critical to make sure we've got lots of spare capacity and stockpiles in place of the things that are needed to ramp up production quickly once we have a vaccine. And that includes manufacturing capacity for vaccines, but also capacity and stockpiles for inputs to vaccine production, like adjuvants or bioreactors or lipids. And there's a cost to maintaining those stockpiles. Private companies, it's not like they're going to be able to fully make that up during a pandemic, because there'll be social limitations on pricing. And they know that. So basically, we need some public funding to help support the costs of maintaining those stockpiles and that sort of standby capacity. I'd also note that, not only is there a huge direct benefit, again, it's a matter of probabilities. It's like insurance, we might pay for it for a while and not need it, but, it's really worth it when you need it, and it's worth taking the quote risk that a pandemic doesn't happen again for, 30 years. And for 30 years, we've paid for some stockpiles. Doing the math on that suggests it's worth it. Look, some things are going to go obsolete during the period they're in stockpile. Fine, accept that cost. Easy for me to say. I realize it might be harder for politicians, but let me emphasize something that's not so obvious. It's not just the direct benefit of having these stockpiles. There's certain shortages are just really destructive in a bunch of ways. Again, a basic lesson of economics. So if the price doesn't rise to the market clearing level, again, to go back to dry economics, that, and that might be totally appropriate, but it does mean that people really want to grab hold of vaccines then, because and that, how do they do that? Well, a bunch of ways. For example, export controls. You know, a lot of countries have either threatened to or actually put on some sort of export controls to keep the vaccine at home or to keep the supply, the ingredients for the supply chain at home. Well, you know, or another one that we talked about, we were just talking about sort of hoarding of vaccines. You know, well, we might need it, so we better hold on to it, as opposed to, you know, there's huge, you know, there's a terrible crisis going on in India right now. And, you know, there's, so the, so how could, you can appeal to make moral appeals. Don't do that. Well, you know, politicians are responsible to their constituencies. They have very strong incentives to get reelected and not to be accused of, you know, favoring other countries' citizens over their own. And so I think you, it's not enough to make the moral appeal. You also need to change the incentives. And the fundamental way to change the incentives is to make sure we've got enough capacity and stockpiles that the, that, you know, either we don't have shortages or the shortages are, you know, mild and transient, not expected to last. And then the incentives of the politicians to allow export of vaccines will be much stronger. So not only is, I keep sort of saying, well, not only this, but there's more. The other thing is that affects, you're not only helping avoid these export bans and hoarding and other activities, but you're, it's the fear of those things is also very destructive. Because remember earlier I was saying we assumed there was a small chance of success for any one vaccine candidate? We got lucky. You know, it's in with vaccine production. Partly there were, you know, there was, you know, good investments made, but partly we were lucky that so many of them worked and we have so many successful vaccines. There's different platforms, different technological approaches, and then different companies. And, you know, some things, you know, work, some things don't. Well, it's right now, there's a huge political impulse to say we need to build our own production facilities within our own country and rely on those. You know, it's much better if we live in a world, then every country is exposed to huge risk. What if they pick the wrong bet? It's too expensive for, you know, maybe the US and China could have lots of, you know, for each of the different production approaches, invest in everything. That's, you know, that's not going to be possible for Canada or Australia. You know, Australia did make a big bet actually on domestic production this time, and it didn't work out, you know, and, you know, much better that we all, we take advantage of comparative advantage. That, you know, US was particularly good at mRNA vaccines. That turned out to work. Great for us. But maybe those wouldn't have worked. And the technologies that China had a lot of capacity and would have worked. You know, there's all sorts of geopolitical rivalries. But, you know, we saw in the Cold War, the smallpox, even geopolitical rivals were able to cooperate on certain issues. And, you know, the efficiency gains from having the possibility of trade and not having export bans looming are huge. And that's vital to countries other than the very largest countries like the US and China. But it's very valuable even for US and China that we can use, you know, the Pfizer vaccine, that's using technology developed in Germany. You know, we need to be able to draw on the resources of the entire world. And that means being able to have a lot of stockpiles and standby capacity. So whatever vaccine works, we can ramp up production of that. And it's very hard to get political agreement on that when after the fact, when we know, well, which places are being hit the hardest, which places have the technology that looks like it's going to work, et cetera. So behind the veil of ignorance, so to speak, you know, we might be able to sign up to an enforceable system for it's only going to be enforceable if you build out the capacity where, you know, really, you know, there can be lots of shots on goal and all countries kind of access to the most successful vaccine, rather than having to rely on what Australia Australia relying on what's produced in Australia.
All right. Wow, that was very interesting. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk to me today. It was a very, very interesting talk.
Great. Good. Very good to talk.